Radio Buddhist Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You're listening to the sound of universal compassion. Please enjoy.
Hello, welcome to the program, and I hope your week and your practice have gone well. On www.spiritual-short-stories.com, there's a very short tale titled A Piece of Truth, and it goes like this. One day, Mara, the evil one, was traveling through the villages of India with his attendants. He saw a man doing walking meditation whose face was lit up on wonder. The man had just discovered something on the ground in front of him. Mara's attendant asked what that was, and Mara replied, "A piece of truth." "Doesn't this bother you when somebody finds a piece of truth, O evil one?" his attendant asked. "No," Mara replied. "Right after this, they usually make a belief out of it." This story seems to me to embody a little of the slogan we were talking about last week. Don't turn a god into a demon. Is it any wonder that so many people say religion is the cause of the most strife in the world? We take the liberating spiritual experience of a great master and turn it into a belief system. We make an experience that is ineffable, indescribable, and dynamic into something that we can clutch onto and transform into a monolithic edifice we label the only truth. And around that, egos love to strive one against the other. Other disciples do the same with their teacher's experience, and now these religious fortresses stand scowling against each other. And Mara laughs and laughs. Today we're going to look at how a god has been turned into a demon in Myanmar. But before that, let's start with motivation. If the best motivation is truly embedded in us, it will be difficult for us to make our gods into demons. But we fear for ourselves and our lives, and that limits us. And whatever limits us allows harmful forces to influence us, and then easily that part of us that is a god is turned into a demon. What is the best motivation? Well, if you've been with us before, you will know by now, I hope, that it's bodhicitta. The motivation to become enlightened for the benefit of all beings. When we truly have wisdom and the well-being of all beings at heart, how can we allow our revelation to become something solid and ultimate, something to be protected and thus harmful? So, in the spirit of this story, and with a wish that our liberation does not become a cause for others' sorrow, let's set a bodhicitta motivation for the program today. Thank you. Another story, quite a famous one in the Bible, talks tellingly to me about the difference between true spirituality and religion. It is the story about an adulteress who was brought before Jesus for judgment. Osho tells it so beautifully in oshostories.wordpress.com that I'd like to quote it here today. It goes like this. Some people brought a woman to Jesus and said, "She has committed adultery. It is written in the ancient scriptures that she should be stoned to death. What do you think?" Jesus was sitting on the bank of a river. He must have fallen deep in thought. "If I tell them to stone her to death, it will be violence. Then what will happen to Jesus' principle of love? And if I say no, pardon her, people will be angry. People will say, 'You're speaking against our ancient religion. You are repudiating our ancient scriptures.'" In reality, that is what people wanted. The people had come to stone Jesus with these stones if he said to pardon her, because he's speaking in opposition to our religious scriptures. And if he says to stone her, "We will kill this woman," and they then say to Jesus, "Well, what happened to your love, to your compassion? Where is your compassion gone? Where is your love gone? It was all phony talk." But they did not know what Jesus would answer. Jesus said the ancient scriptures are right. They must be right. Take up stones and kill this woman. But let only those throw stones who have never committed adultery, nor who have ever even thought of committing adultery. And the five who had stood before the villagers probably all mayors and members of the municipal committee, quickly retreated into the crowd. Who wants trouble? The whole village knew. Everyone's mischief was known. And if they hadn't committed adultery, they certainly had thought of it. To find a man who has not thought of adultery is difficult, one who has not been infatuated, who has not been attracted. All quietly moved back. Slowly, slowly, the people who had come with stones in their hands let the stones fall where they stood. And slowly, slowly, people began to disappear. Evening was falling. The sun was setting. Just as the sun set and it started to get dark, people escaped from there. The woman was left behind, alone. The woman put her head at Jesus' feet and said, "Give me whatsoever punishment you want. I'm an adulteress. I accept it. I'm a sinner. And your compassion has overwhelmed my heart. Whatsoever punishment you want to give." Jesus said, "Who am I to mete out punishments? Who am I to stand between you and your God? You know what you need to do, and your God knows. I'm not going to make any judgment. If you feel you have done something bad, then don't do it anymore. And if it feels all right to you, then continue. The one to decide is God. The final decision will be between you and God. There is no intermediary. Go now." Osho says, consider what he's saying. A famous statement of Jesus is, "Resist not evil." Not even evil. Why? If God is allowing it to happen, there must be some reason. Wake up within. Live within. But the true thread of life emerges in you. And now let's compare that with something that has been taking place for the last few years in a country ostensibly dedicated to the Buddha's teachings. And remember that the Buddha's teachings are based on non-harm and the non-clinging to views. The country is Myanmar or Burma, and we all know of the persecution of Muslims and especially the Rohingya that has been going on there. With the country's recent military background and history, we might think that the persecution might have something to do with juntas and so on. But no, the harm is primarily coming from the believers in non-harm, Buddhists. Here is an article that appeared in the New York Times in May 2013, written by Thomas Fuller. It is titled, "Extremism Rises Amongst Myanmar Buddhists," and it starts off like this. After a ritual prayer atoning for past sins, Ashin Wiratu, a Buddhist monk with a rock star following in Myanmar, sat before an overflowing crowd of thousands of devotees and launched into a rant against what he called the enemy, the country's Muslim minority. "You can be full of kindness and love, but you cannot sleep next to a mad dog," Ashin Wiratu said, referring to Muslims. "I call them troublemakers because they are troublemakers," Ashin Wiratu told a reporter after his two-hour sermon. "I am proud to be called a radical Buddhist." The article continues, "The world has grown accustomed to a gentle image of Buddhism defined by the self-effacing words of the Dalai Lama, the global popularity of Buddhist-inspired meditation, and postcard-perfect scenes from Southeast Asia and beyond of crimson-robed barefoot monks receiving alms from villages at dawn. But over the past year, images of rampaging Burmese Buddhists carrying swords and the vituperative sermons of monks like Ashin Wiratu have underlined the rise of extreme Buddhism in Myanmar and revealed a darker side of the country's greater freedoms after decades of military rule. Buddhist lynch mobs have killed more than 200 Muslims and forced more than 150,000 people, mostly Muslims, from their homes. Ashin Wiratu denies any role in the riots, but his critics say that at the very least, his anti-Muslim preaching is helping to inspire the violence. The New York Times claims that in a year, a fringe movement had grown into a nationwide anti-Muslim movement that spreads its message through sermons, in person, and on DVD. Community centers and Sunday schools have also been set up by monasteries linked to it. The article goes on, The hate-filled speeches and violence have endangered Myanmar's path to democracy, raising questions about the government's ability to keep the country's towns and cities safe, and its willingness to crack down or prosecute Buddhists in a Buddhist-majority country. The killings have also reverberated in Muslim countries across the region, tarnishing what was almost universally seen abroad as a remarkable and rare peaceful transition from military rule to democracy. In May, the Indonesian authorities foiled what they said was a plot to bomb the Myanmar embassy in Jakarta in retaliation for the assaults on Muslims. Ashin Wiratu, the spiritual leader of the radical movement, skates a thin line between free speech and incitement, taking advantage of loosened restrictions on expression during a fragile time of transition. He was himself jailed for 8 years by the now defunct military junta for inciting hatred. Last year, as part of a release of hundreds of political prisoners, he was freed. In his recent sermon, he described the reported massacre of schoolchildren and other Muslim inhabitants in the central city of Mektila in March, documented by a human rights group, as a show of strength. If we are weak, he said, our land will become Muslim. Now, in an interview with the Guardian newspaper in May of 2017, Wiratu claimed that he is, and I quote, defending my loved one like you would defend your loved one. I'm only warning people about Muslims. Consider it if you had a dog that would bark at strangers coming into your house. It is to warn you. I am like that dog. I bark. And he denies any responsibility for violence resulting from his sermons. But the newspaper writes of eyewitness accounts of monks with knives and wearing denim jeans under their robes exiting Wiratu's monastery during the Mandalay riots in 2013. Says the Guardian article, Islam represents only 5% of Myanmar's population of 54 million, but the nationalists like Wiratu are pushing the idea that the faith puts Buddhism and the very essence of Myanmar in jeopardy. He claims the 1 million Rohingya living in precarious conditions in his country, described by human rights agencies as the most persecuted people on earth, don't exist. It only takes one terrorist to be amongst them, he says. Look at what happened in the West. I do not want that to happen in my country. All I am doing is warning people to be aware. Wiratu apparently has a network of people traversing the internet, infiltrating the Facebook pages of Muslim groups, getting all Islamic schools to record their lessons, and government surveillance of internet activity, including emails. The article continues, on the well-documented situation of the Rohingya in Rakhine State, where people have been left without access to medicines, aid, and basic human necessities, such as clean water, sanitation, and food, Wiratu is dismissive. The Rohingya have been mostly cooped up in camps since the 2012 violence, and the silence of Myanmar's leader Aung San Suu Kyi and her National League for Democracy on their plight has attracted growing criticism. Wiratu rejects the stateless Rohingya as illegal immigrants, a view echoed by the government. He will only discuss them if the description Bangladeshis is used, and even then, Wiratu says the situation is not as it is portrayed. If it is true what outsiders say, then I would offer help, but I have visited the camps on many occasions. The aid agencies are refused access because they are using the refugees to fill their own pockets. Bangladeshis are posing for the media. They're not starving. They have so much food that they are selling it in their shops, stealing even from their own. On the allegations that women have been abused and raped by the military, he laughed. Impossible. Their bodies are too disgusting. Nevertheless, the New York Times article quotes a May 2013 report from Physicians for Human Rights that told of organized attacks against Muslims in central Myanmar in March that resulted in the killing of at least 20 children and 4 teachers. Titled Massacre in Central Burma, Muslim Students Terrorized and Killed in Mektila, the report, I quote the New York Times, details the results of an investigation into the March 20 and 21 attacks on Muslim students, teachers and residents in the Mengala Zayoni quarter of Mektila, a small town in central Burma, also known as Myanmar. The Mengala Zayoni Islamic boarding school, which housed 120 students as young as 11, was set ablaze and destroyed. Attacks and killings continued after police officers forced children and residents to come out from hiding. PHR investigators conducted 33 interviews with the school students and teachers, as well as religious leaders, civil society representatives, and government authorities. Among the 33 respondents were 13 eyewitness survivors of the Mektila massacre, including 8 male students. The eyewitnesses range in age from 9 to 72 and include men, women, boys and girls. All interviewed eyewitnesses are Muslim except for one, who is a non-Muslim member of the parliament. Buddhism would seem to have a secure place in Myanmar. 9 in 10 people are Buddhist, as are nearly all the top leaders in the business world, the government, the military and the police. Estimates of the Muslim minority range from 4% to 8% of Myanmar's roughly 55 million people, while the rest are mostly Christian or Hindu. All this doesn't matter. Ashin Viratu sees Buddhism is under siege because Muslims are buying up the land and raising more children than Buddhists. But the New York Times says Buddhists in other countries are alarmed at what he and his followers are up to. Says the article, the Dalai Lama, after the riots in March, said killing in the name of religion was unthinkable and urged Myanmar Buddhists to contemplate the face of the Buddha for guidance. Fra Paisal Visalo, a Buddhist scholar and prominent monk in neighboring Thailand, says the notion of us and them promoted by Myanmar's radical monks is anathema to Buddhism. But he lamented that his criticism and that of other leading Buddhists outside the country have had very little impact. Myanmar monks are quite isolated and have a thin relationship with Buddhists in other parts of the world, Fra Paisal said. One exception is Sri Lanka, another country historically bedeviled by ethnic strife. Burmese monks have been inspired by the assertive political role played by monks from Sri Lanka's Sinhalese majority. As Myanmar has grown more polarized, there have been nascent signs of a backlash against the anti-Muslim preaching. Among the most disappointed with the outbreaks of violence and hateful rhetoric are some of the leaders of the 2007 Saffron Revolution, a peaceful uprising led by Buddhist monks against military rule. We were not expecting this violence when we chanted for peace and reconciliation in 2007, said the abbot of Pauk Jari Monastery, Ashinyana Nika, 55, who attended a meeting earlier this month sponsored by Muslim groups to discuss the issue. Ashin is the honorific for Burmese monks. Ashin Sandawara, the head of a monastic school in Yangon, says the monks in the country are divided nearly equally between moderates and extremists. He considers himself in the moderate camp, but as a measure of the deeply ingrained suspicions towards Muslims in the society, he said he was afraid of Muslims because their population is increasing so rapidly. Ashin Wiratu has tapped into that anxiety, which some describe as the demographic pressures coming from neighboring Bangladesh. There is wide disdain in Myanmar for a group of about 1 million stateless Muslims who call themselves Rohingya, some of whom are migrated from Bangladesh. Clashes between the Rohingya and Buddhists last year in western Myanmar roiled the Buddhist community and appear to have played a role in later outbreaks of violence throughout the country. Ashin Viratu said they served as his inspiration to spread his teachings. The theme song to Ashin Viratu's movement speaks of people who live in our land, drink our water, and are ungrateful to us. We will build a fence with our bones if necessary, runs the song's refrain. Muslims are not explicitly mentioned in the song, but Ashin Viratu says the lyrics refer to them. Pamphlets handed out at his sermon demonizing Muslims said that Myanmar is currently facing a most dangerous and fearful poison that is severe enough to eradicate all civilization. Many in Myanmar speculate, without offering proof, that Ashin Wiratu is allied with hardline Buddhist elements in the country who want to harness the nationalism of his movement to rally support ahead of elections in 2015. Ashin Wiratu denies any such links, but the government has done little to rein him in. During Ashin Wiratu's visit here in Taungi, traffic police cleared the intersections for his motorcade. Once inside the monastery, as part of a highly choreographed visit, his followers led a procession through crowds of followers who prostrated themselves as he passed. The article continues, Ashin Wiratu's movement calls itself 969, three digits that monks say symbolize the virtues of the Buddha, Buddha practices, and the Buddhist community. Stickers with the movement's logo are now ubiquitous nationwide on cars, motorcycles, and shops. The movement has also begun a signature campaign calling for a ban on interfaith marriages, and pamphlets are distributed at sermons listing Muslim brands and shops to be avoided. In Moulamieni, a multicultural city southeast of Yangon, a monastery linked to the 969 movement has established the courses of Buddhist instruction for children, which it calls Sunday Dharma schools. Leaders of the monasteries there seek to portray their campaign as a sort of Buddhist revivalist movement. The main thing is that our religion and our nationality don't disappear, said Ashin Zadila, a senior monk at the Maya Zidi Nanu Monastery outside the city. Yet, despite efforts at describing the movement as non-threatening, many Muslims are worried. 2 hours before Ashin Wiratu rolled into Taungi in a motorcade that included 60 honking motorcycles, Tun Tun Nyang, a Muslim vendor in the city's central market, spoke of the visit in a whisper. I'm really frightened, he said, stopping in mid-sentence when customers entered his shop. We tell the children not to go outside unless absolutely necessary. That's the New York Times. And it's difficult to believe that this was a Buddhist monk dedicated to all the Buddha taught and stood for. In fact, it seems very much what the Buddha taught us not to do, and we can only guess what kind of karma Ashin Wiratu is accumulating, but I bet it's not of the good type. Is it obvious to you that this monk is turning a god into a raging demon? He is turning the most compassionate and wise teachings in the world into a vehicle for racism, hatred, antagonism, and fear. Even the state Sangha Mahanayaka, the body of senior monks in Myanmar, understood this and banned him from sermonizing from the 10th of March 2017 to the 9th of March 2018 because he had, and I quote, repeatedly delivered hate speech against religions to cause communal strife and hinder efforts to uphold the rule of law. But now let's turn to another Buddhist monk, the most famous one of all, His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Look at the difference in his attitude in a teaching that strikes my heart and which I've admittedly quoted more than once in previous programs. It's from his book, The Compassionate Life, and it goes, I must emphasize again that merely thinking that compassion and reason and patience are good will not be enough to develop them. We must wait for difficulties to arise and then attempt to practice them. And who creates such opportunities? Not our friends, of course, but our enemies. They're the ones who give us the most trouble. So if we truly wish to learn, we should consider enemies our best teachers. For a person who cherishes compassion and love, the practice of patience is essential, and for that, enemies are indispensable. So we're grateful to our enemies, for it is they who can help us to develop a tranquil mind. Furthermore, it is often the case in both personal and public life that with a change in circumstances, enemies become friends. Of course, it is natural and right that we all want friends. But is friendship produced through quarrels and anger, jealousy and intense competitiveness? I do not think so. The best way to make friends is to be very compassionate. Only affection brings us genuine close friends. You should take good care of others, be concerned for their welfare, help them, serve them, make more friends, make more smiles. The result? When you yourself need help, you'll find plenty of helpers. If, on the other hand, you neglect the happiness of others, in the long term, you will be the loser. In today's materialistic society, if you have money and power, you may seem to have many friends. But they are not friends of yours, they are friends of your money and power. When you lose your wealth and influence, you will find it very difficult to track these people down. The trouble is that when things in the world go well for us, we become confident that we can manage by ourselves, and we feel we do not need friends. But as our status or health declines, we quickly realize how wrong we were. So, to prepare for that time, to make genuine friends who will help us when the need arises, we ourselves must cultivate compassion. Though sometimes people laugh when I say it, I myself always want more friends. I love smiles. Because of this, I have the problem of knowing how to make more friends and how to get more smiles, in particular genuine smiles. There are other kinds of smiles, such as sarcastic, artificial, or diplomatic smiles. Many smiles produce no feeling of satisfaction, and sometimes they can even create suspicion or fear, can't they? But a genuine smile really gives us a feeling of freshness, and is, I believe, unique to human beings. If these are the smiles we want, then we ourselves must create the reasons for them to appear. How do we make friends? Certainly not through hatred and confrontation. It is impossible to make friends by hitting people and fighting with them. A genuine friendship can emerge only through cooperation based on honesty and sincerity. And this means having an open mind and a warm heart. This, I think, is obvious from our own everyday interaction with others. In a 2008 appeal to the people who truly have oppressed his people for decades, he said this: "Today I extend heartfelt greetings to my Chinese brothers and sisters around the world, particularly to those in the People's Republic of China. I am deeply saddened by the loss of life and the recent tragic events in Tibet. I am aware that some Chinese have also died. I feel for the victims and their families and pray for them. The recent unrest has clearly demonstrated the gravity of the situation in Tibet and the urgent need to seek a peaceful, official solution through dialogue. Even at this juncture, I've expressed my willingness to the Chinese authorities to work together to bring about peace and stability." Isn't that how to avoid turning a god into a demon? And with that, I will leave you today as our time is up. Thanks for joining the program, and I hope you will do so again next week. Please dedicate any positive potential to attaining enlightenment for the sake of all living beings. Thank you, and goodbye.